I think so. Yes. Dr. Sadlock? Dr. Popio?
Yeah.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Here.
Ms. Gallen?
Here.
Dr. Campbell?
Here.
Dr. Spatt?
Here.
Dr. Rubin? Ms. Asta, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. We have quorum.
Okay. So let's move on to case number 20. Dr. Porter. Yeah, do you have the number, case number?
Yes. Jason Porter is 2168.
For that, Dr. Rubin?
Both times, yes.
Okay. All right. Gail, can you give us the synopsis on Dr. Porter?
Dr. Rubin, members of the board, this is case number 20-168. On around the first 2 weeks in May of 2020, the State of Arizona Naturopathic Physicians Medical Board received information from an Arizona Department of Public Safety officer. The information relayed to board staff indicated that there was an ongoing investigation involving Dr. Jason Porter. The allegations in the case was his use of another physician's DEA number. Evidence provided to board staff indicated Dr. Jason Porter's use and or instructed clinic staff to use the DEA number of Dr. Julie Kiefer. Upon initial notice from DPS, a board investigation was opened, and after review of the CSPMP, board staff subpoenaed the medical records for 8 patients. In summary, review of those records found the following. Dr. Porter failed to perform a physical examination, including vital signs, at any time during the course of treatment for 8 out of the 8 patients. Records were reviewed. With the exception of vitals charted for patient DW for the dates of service 1/31 of 2020 and 6/2 of 2020, Dr. Porter failed to keep adequate medical records for 8 of the 8 patients records reviewed. Dr. Porter prescribed controlled substances for members of his immediate family, specifically his wife. As evidenced by prescription copies obtained from several pharmacies, Dr. Porter prescribed out-of-scope prescriptions, oxycodone, acetaminophen, 3 times between January of 2018 and October of 2019. In review of the patient records, it appears they are primarily cut and paste and are carryover information. The patient charts for JP, respondent's wife, were subpoenaed according to the CSPMP. Respondent prescribed phentermine, a controlled substance, to his wife on 9/9/2019, 3/16/2020, 4/15/2020, 5/14/2020. According to the CSPMP, respondent prescribed ketamine, a controlled substance, to his wife on 6/23/2020 and 10/1/2020. All had authorized refills.
Did this a month ago. I mean, the case basically pretty much is clear that he did write positive scope. So we need to come to closure as to what we would like. We want a letter of reprimand with conditions, and then we'll hear from Dr. Porter here in a moment. But we're dealing with the fact that he did write prescriptions. What
the medication that, so, is that correct? That's your
answer? Yes, medication.
Well, if from our last meeting, we can discuss how in attempting to send a prescription that's in scope, when we type it into the practice using software, again, I was typing in a different medication and apparently another medication came up. And again, I didn't recognize that when I printed it off, it changed it. And again, I know well enough what the out-of-scope medications are. And so again, even that was a surprise to me because I said I know better and I don't prescribe those medications for any reason or purpose. If as evidence we added with the with Del Salazar, the former DA agent, I did a live text test. He asked me the question whether or not I knowingly prescribed oxycodone or oxycontin, which I replied no. And he confirmed that that was the case, that there was no evidence of I guess no evidence that I did that. Errors in the practice fusion software, which again historically practice fusion was cited for lots of litigation for promotion medications. And I think when you type in certain medications, there's gone up other ones that weren't necessarily included as an option in the formulary. And again, I typed in one and something else generated or popped up. So again, all we can tell is it was accidentally generated in the system when I was trying to prescribe another medication.
Do you look at what is, after you type it in, do you look at what that medication is, especially since you're dealing with a C2 medication?
I do. Well, I mean, I usually trust if I start to type something and I click on it, I assume that what prints out should be what I clicked on. Certainly at this point, we don't print medic control for scripts anymore at this point. Everything's sent in electronically, obviously, at this point. So, you know, that issue won't obviously happen again. And so that's good. But no, I didn't before. I just didn't think, I suppose, what I clicked on was fill in. I assume that's what's going to print out. I don't review it a second time as it comes out of the printer. Not something I thought I ever had to do or consider. We don't prescribe pain meds that often. That's the problem. I mean, like, we don't do it that often. When we do, again, it's like any other controlled script. Again, if it's printed off, we assume that what reflected was still there on the printed page.
Okay, and then what about the fenfluramine with your wife?
Oh, well, that one's easy. I mean, the doctor, the keeper, who was her primary care, wasn't available. My wife was had benefit with this medication historically. We had that reviewed at Mayo Clinic and with Phoenix Neurology, and Dr. Kiefer had described before. But, you know, so I said, I'll take care of that, and because I can't get hold of Dr. Kiefer to get that approved. You know, so that I take responsibility for that. I can't deny that one.
You realize that's a problem?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, I could say my wife is extremely ill, and her medication she highly depends upon, and it's difficult to skip a day or two without them, without significant suffering or disability. She's already disabled, so again, that was my attempt to do my best.
What was your logic? Was it for weight? Did you use it for something different than weight loss?
Yes, absolutely. It's used as a form of a stimulant. Upon laboratory testing, catecholamine testing, which includes norepinephrine and noradrenaline, she had zero or non again, no evidence of adrenaline. Again, in the research, particularly associated with lectin, showed that certain herbs and certain medications can raise adrenaline, giving somebody some inkling of normalcy, a little energy. Again, it's the only potential stimulant of that, you know, that's the control stimulant that we're allowed to prescribe as naturopaths.
Okay, let me ask, I'm going to put this with my other board members and get their opinions. So if you don't mind, Dr. Papil, let me start up on the top with you.
Well, I'm not going to say that we've dealt with all these issues, Dr. Sadler, so I'm under the impression that we're also mainly researching this and about to keep it and go through all of that information. But to continue this line of questioning, Dr. Porter, I'm trying to find which part, but it looks like back in 2011, 2012, that you were writing for the phentermine and the benzodiazepines for your wife. Is that correct? And then at some point, I don't know when Dr. Kiefer joined your office, but at some point, either, you know, she took her scripts or, depending on your perspective on this case, you started writing scripts under her DEA. However it went, at some point, the scripts transitioned to Dr. Kiefer, but historically, you were writing not only fentanyl, but benzos as well.
Yeah, my wife.
Relaxers as well.
Yeah, in 2011, my wife fell ill, developed neck pain. Every attempt we did acupuncture, massage, chiropractic, PRP, prolo injections. Every attempt to relieve her pain was ineffective. I tried her on a muscle relaxant. This was chronic debilitating pain. She couldn't sleep. I tried her on a muscle. Again, I've seen multiple physicians or practitioners. I tried her on a muscle relaxant. That helped a little bit. We tried a benzodiazepine. That helped more. And so that's how it started. We thought it was just a muscle injury from working out. But every attempt to reduce or remove the medications was ineffective. And we began to recognize that just whatever it was becoming chronic. And so I said, I can't keep doing this. And so I consulted with Dr. Kiefer at the time and who my wife was seeing, had been seeing for a number of years. And Dr. Kiefer had already been in the practice for at least 2 years. And so they had a relationship, and I reviewed the case and what was going on. And Dr. Kiefer said she was willing to help and to move forward. And again, in time, we found out there was other problems. She had Lyme disease and other problems.
Okay. And so, I mean, just to kind of jump into all the he said, she said stuff and where all the info we got from Dr. Kiefer. So it appears that based on intra-office communication that there are numerous times when you guys were writing scripts where your staff would question you and say, hey, let's say the pharmacy needs this in, and you would say, yeah, send it in, put it under Dr. Kiefer. It seems odd to me that the communication would not be with Dr. Kiefer herself, rather your staff asking you whether or not to fill the script and you saying put it under Dr. Kiefer. Why would that communication not have been directly with Dr. Kiefer, and why would have you been even involved?
Well, it has to do with two things. One, I'm there every day. Dr. Kiefer wasn't there every day. So if a refill prescription request came in, faxed, or my wife called the office and requested it, again, the question came up naturally, certainly in the beginning. They're like, hey, this is your wife, Dr. Porter. You know, who's filling this? I go, well, Dr. Kiefer's agreed to fill this. You can go ahead and renew it. You can ask her, or I asked her, and again, these are all very ongoing, you know, fluid conversations that are happening on a regular basis, certainly in the beginning. And over time, they have their own little happenings. They get, you know, more communicated via staff, you know, through the medical assistant. But in the beginning, there was confusion about, hey, who's treating her? Because, like I say, it was my wife. And my wife worked in the office with us, so everybody knew her. So again, the staff has, you know, trying to create clarity on who is the, you know, I guess her primary care doctor and who's taking care of her. Again, obviously I'm supporting her. I'm doing the best I can as her husband, but again, trying to, you know, make it clean as far as who's taking care of her. So there's some communication about that.
I appreciate that. I just feel like if we're in a position where we have controlled substances and there's already, because there's a statement for 2012 when your staff was communicating with you saying, and this is direct verbatim from your staff, something to the effect of, hey, these prescriptions for controlled substances are getting out of control. They need to be done by another doctor. So given that we're dealing with controlled substances, given that you understand that, you know, this is a significant issue, I guess I feel like, yes, there's busy staff and there's a lot going on and maybe Dr. Keith's not at the office, but for clarity's sake and for your own sake, it seems as if you didn't really get the message that you'd be involved in controlled substances in any way, shape, or form in decision-making for your wife. Did that ever kind of cross your mind? Like, I shouldn't be involved at all. I shouldn't be in coordinating her care for controlled substances at all, regardless of whether this physician is in my clinic or not.
Well, that's, I mean, your observation, obviously at this point, very on target, absolutely. But my relationship with Dr. Kiefer in this way was, we've been some friends or known each other for 18 years. When a doctor says to me, hey, whatever Julie needs, and hey, this is fine, and I'll take care of that, again, it's a little more relaxed. And yeah, absolutely. Again, we had no concern at this point that I had to be, I don't know, militant and just tell my wife, you know, don't talk to me, Dr. Kiefer. And I get that at this point, that's what we should have done. And that would have really fixed a lot of these problems, or really figured out early on if Dr. Kiefer was willing to prescribe, as she had said she was. But either way, it would have resolved some issues if we were of that nature. But again, we had no concern. And again, this is eight years of prescribing. Again, at no point was ever any concern raised by Dr. Kiefer at any point, either to my wife or to myself or other practicing doctors or the staff, that this was a concern ever. And she knew she was on medication. There's no way she could know because we talked about it regularly.
All right, well, and let's just play devil's advocate for a second. I don't use your EHR system, I use a different one. Is there any way, in your opinion, that all of these prescriptions, because a lot of them did end up in the chart. So is there any way that these prescriptions could have been done and Dr. Kiefer not aware that all of these prescriptions were being written under her name?
Impossible. To be written under someone's name, you have to log in using their email and their password. And no physician or staff member knows any doctor's login or password. They may know their login password, their username, but your password was designed to be held by you, and you don't share that with anybody. Whether other doctors share it with the staff, I don't know that. But I don't share that with anybody, and I don't know what they share with me. So there's no way for me to log in under Dr. Kiefer's name and send anything in using her name. Which means,
so how did you ever send them in? You're calling the pharmacy on all of it?
Every prescription was called in by a staff member. I'm going to say 98% of them, the majority of them, 38 to 40 prescriptions over the 8 years, every one of them was physically called in to the pharmacist.
Gotcha.
Each medical assistant, had a request either from my wife would call the office, or she called the notify the office manager, she needed a refill, she might say me. I would notify the medical assistant, hey, my wife said she needs a refill, reach out to Dr. Kiefer. Whatever way it came through, everything went through the medical assistant. There's never a time when I called in, and or again, never a time, I don't call in any scripts, not even for my own patients, but I don't call in any scripts, certainly for my wife in this regard, using Dr. Kiefer's name or license.
And so on all these phone calls that you guys made for scripts for your wife, your staff is documenting a chart note for every single one of these prescriptions? Because just looking at your wife's file, it doesn't look like all of these scripts would have been, are showing up here based at least at what we're seeing.
Well, yeah, well, that's half the problem. Meaning DPS and Dr. Tiefer, well, whatever Dr. Tiefer's motivation, but DPS, of the 40 scripts that were done, only two had written chart notes, meaning there was nothing ever charted. Again, when I work with a patient, I have an ongoing treatment plan, and then every time we renew that or we fill that, we at least have the medications and the supplements that they're doing or whatever the other protocols are listed there, and that's what would have been there normally. But in this case, when you review the Arizona Pharmacy Board, the PMP, again, there are 40 medications, not, you know, none of them were documented. And again, and so what happens is, you know, everybody says, well, it wasn't documented, and doctor says, well, I always start every time I do something, and they go, well, hell, who did this? Well, it has to be Dr. Porter. So they just pointed fingers. In the absence of any evidence, they just said, it's my fault, which it sounds crazy to me that that's the case. And understand that nobody ever came to me or any other staff member or my office manager or even my business partner and say, hey, there's something going on here. All these missing chart notes, is someone doing something they shouldn't be? We didn't know about anything for a year after any of these assumed assumptions came across.
I hear you. So what, I guess my point is let's say Dr. Tiefer wasn't in the office and you guys took it upon yourself to fill a script for her. Would you not also take it upon yourself to make a chart note denoting that this prescription has been called in on behalf of Dr. Tiefer? Because that's the argument you're also using to discredit Dr. Tiefer, is that you guys ran a PMP report and say, okay, this script was called in, but there's no chart note. I also don't see you guys, for all of the scripts your staff called in on behalf of Dr. Tiefer, I also don't see a chart note for all of those prescriptions either.
We don't have it as a policy that the staff make the chart note for that. We expect or require that the doctor make the chart note. And as my wife saw Dr. Tiefer, on an average every 2.5 to 3 months over those 8 years, again, I would take it upon my thinking to say she must be keeping track and charting. So she's allowing these things to, she's giving permission for these things to be filled to the staff as they come through. I'm not initiating these. These are being initiated by many from different directions. My wife would come in and be there personally and ask the staff or Dr. Tiefer personally. Or she would call the office manager and say, hey, I need a refill on this prescription. And I never knows at this point that Dr. Tiefer is in charge of that. And they don't come to me. And only towards the end where my wife is disabled and in bed and could not, you know, function and physically come to the office, did I start taking on more of a personal responsibility to just pass on a note to individuals that say, hey, she needs refill, forward that to Dr. Tiefer.
Gotcha.
I don't know, did I answer that question?
Yeah, that's fine. I understand what you're saying. So I guess the other question would be, you know, you and your attorney have made some statements as to motivations, if you will, as to how things went the way that they did. So in your impression, how are we here today as far as the massive discrepancy between what Dr. Tiefer's perspective is and your perspective? How did we get here today if you were to make a guess, if you will?
This is pure speculation. Listen, when it started, and he was aware of this problem in December or January of 2020. And I didn't know there was a problem until December of 2020, nearly a year later. So was I notified that there's even a case or an investigation against me? I have no idea. She never complained any problem. But we'll say this. She complained frequently of paying too much rent, which we require 35% rent from her of all profits, which is extremely fair. She complained and felt like she was maybe taken advantage of when Dr. Nevels and I, my business partner, bought and expanded our office. Maybe she felt like she was paying too much rent and paying for things that she didn't, feel like she needed to be paying for. I don't really know, but either way, there's this moment where there's this recognition of a potential problem, but rather than talking it out, she directs it all towards me and makes up a story that she shares with me that I send you. And has no, well, I don't really know where it comes from, to be honest. I think that in the end, there's this idea that all of a sudden, hey, I didn't write all this stuff out. And all of a sudden, the realization is, well, that's not my problem. I shouldn't have done that. Well, somebody else must have done it. People want to blame somebody else because they can't take responsibility when they did that. And if they had taken responsibility, say, hey, this happened. Have we been turning this? Well, there's so much. I'll go, well, let's practice. Let's see now. Let's have it. Is there a communication error in the office? But that none of that happened, so I don't really know. I can only guess.
I'm trying to understand the logic. I believe kind of the idea that maybe there was some sort of her covering up for her lack of charting, which would trigger this. I'm not following it because it seems like bringing light to the chart notes would provide further concern over lack of charting if that is the case for her. So can you and your lawyer elaborate on where you're coming from with the idea that this is a cover-up to cover her lack of charting potentially?
Well, Dr. Kiefer complains frequently to myself and other doctors in the office how difficult it was to keep up in charting and how behind she was always behind in charting and how hard it was. So that was a constant concern and complaint. And so I think that was a sensitive area for her. I think she was stressed by it. And again, I think when she recognized this, I think it added more, I guess, stress to her situation and took it and made it more personal as opposed to, again, the broad issue of just learning how to fix things. You know, taking the time to prep notes. Every doctor in her office is in the office at 7:30. She came in between 8:30 to 9:30. So again, taking the time to prep for your day was a very important aspect of that. And again, that was a common complaint and concern she had.
Okay.
I don't know, Mel, do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, let me just indicate, this is Mel McDonald. I've been representing Dr. Porter in this. A lot of what we put in the letters to the board, we can't look in her mind to try to figure out what a motive is. One of the things we did, I retained the services of a former FBI agent, went around and interviewed many of the people in their office to confirm that they would reach out to Dr. Kiefer, hey, is it okay to refill this? Is it okay to do this? So the communication was being made by staff in the office. When DPS did their investigation, they interviewed a couple of people, but there was an office full of staff over many years. And the thing that baffled us and baffles us to this day, in her civil lawsuit, which blows me away why she's now suing my client trying to get a lot of money for what, she refers to them as being friends. If I've got a friend and there's a problem, I will approach the friend. If there's a problem in the way it's happening, if she wants to have staff people come in and give her something in writing and she signs off, that's what would be the case. But if you've got a treatment that you've been doing for a long time, and he would communicate to the staff, check with her, she needs to fill this or that. And the staff people have confirmed to our investigators that they would check with her. And then finally had this mindset. She was in the office for 6 months after she heard this complaint in. What kind of a friend and colleague pulls that kind of garbage with somebody that you've been with all these years, that his wife is a patient for over a decade? And to turn this into law enforcement, turn it into the board, jeopardize his position. So when we sat down and drafted the letter, you try to find what would be the possible motive. I can't read her mind. There was some disagreement she had with his church beliefs, and she would sometimes mock some of those beliefs. There were financial issues in that. So
I can't know what the motive is. I can't know why she doesn't. If there's a problem, just come out and reach. Other than maybe, I thought it was interesting that she suddenly filed the big civil lawsuit trying to get all kinds of money for this so-called harm, when there's witness after witness that was in that office that would say they went to her and got the okay before they would call it in.
Gotcha. Okay. I believe that is all my questions for now. If any other board members want to chime in.
Dr. Campbell, your thoughts on this? Or questions for Dr. Porter?
I'm going through my list here. Many have been answered. I do have a question respective to the initiation of a new script by Dr. Kiefer writing and identifying a script for Dr. Porter's wife, and that's sent in, and then at that point, depending on the medication, it would allow for, you know, the prescription is on file with the pharmacy. It would allow for refills, you know, depending on the medication, and that's what allows staff members to be able to simply confirm or, you know, approve or deny a script on behalf of a particular physician in the office. And so when you step back and take a broader look at it, it is pretty easy to for an employee to approve or deny a medication when it is simply a matter of checking a box or saying yes or no to the pharmacist who's inquiring. And so Dr. Porter mentioned earlier about a time when he was asked by staff about refilling Dr. Kiefer's prescription, and because she hadn't been in, and so the staff would logically come to him under the perception that, well, she's been prescribing this medication and it's due now, so go ahead. Can you elaborate on, you know, what was going on and how you justified the decision to, you know, other than the fact that Dr. Kiefer wasn't present, and other than the knowledge that she had been treating and prescribing a particular medication, how do you justify simply arbitrarily approving verbally a refill of a medication just in that sense? How are you justifying that in your head to just simply approve it? Well, okay, she has been taking it for a while, and just, you know, obviously Dr. Kiefer is okay with it, and so go ahead with it.
There is no need for justification. Everything was given by her permission, meaning she and I had talked about it. So when it came up, or anything, you know, again, these are things that are coming in, and we've just had discussions, and I say these are acute issues in the beginning and then become more chronic later. Even as I took my wife to Mayo Clinic and I took her to Phoenix Neurology, these doctors would review the medications. We developed new diagnoses such as mast cell disease, erythromelalgia, polyneuropathy. These are serious conditions that have no known cures. And so there'll be suggestions, or the research department and I talked about, say, hey, we're looking at changing from clonazepam to alprazolam. People say it works better. Hey, we want to reduce this medication or dose. Hey, we're not sleeping. Can we look at prescribing Ambien? These are conversations that are happening, again, in the office and around times when she's in the office. We talk all the time. This idea that we don't see each other and we hardly know each other is crazy, because it's a small, intimate office. Everybody's stepping on each other's toes. We rub elbows all day long.
Not to interrupt you, sir, but I guess I understand that, and I understand the demographics, and I'm there's no disputing that your wife was sick. There's no reference to why at some point she wasn't placed under the care of a board certified pain physician. None of that is an issue. What is at issue is that whether it is a written script that you take out as a doctor and write a medication, a quantity, and a dose amount, and physically hand it to a patient who turns it into a pharmacist or a pharmacist's office who comes to you and says, this patient wants a refill of a medication that's on file with us. Each time that happens, there is a particular duty on behalf of the physician, on behalf of the office, to make sure that the initial prescribing doctor is okay with that medication being refilled again, that there are no indications that the patient needs to be reevaluated, that there's no abuse of the medication, that there are no safety issues. And so only the physician, the treating physician, should know that information. I mean, obviously you do as a husband, but with respect to approving, every time that new prescription was approved as a refill, it should have come from Dr. Kiefer and nobody else, regardless if you have 20 other physicians saying, well, hypothetically, absolutely, take this medication. That really is beside the point. The issue in the law is that we're responsible for every prescription we write. And because of that, it also includes refills. And when we just arbitrarily say, well, yes, all of our colleagues agree that it should be prescribed, she prescribed it to begin with, she's refilled authorizations before, so go ahead with it now. How do we justify that decision? You say that there's no need to justify it.
Well,
is that
we didn't ask, that wasn't our intention.
Okay.
Go ahead, sorry.
No, is that your response? Your official response is there's no need to justify it?
No, I agree with everything you said. Our thinking is not what you described. Our thinking is that the doctor has always been, a prescribing doctor is and always has been and always will be the responsible physician. I never took it upon myself at any point to assume that it was automatically to happen. Meaning every attempt, and if I was engaged in it, every attempt to communicate with Dr. Kiefer was made. Again, I did not always communicate with her directly. I would have given it to a staff member and say, this needs to be refilled. Will you communicate and pass it on to Dr. Kiefer and get a refill? We had, for example, two individuals in the 10 medications in which I was indicted on, two were prescribed by Misty Carroll and two by Riley. Both have given testimony that they personally asked Dr. Kiefer to authorize refills for these medications. So that was our process and our procedure. I've never, again, taken it upon myself to assume anything other than to communicate clearly to individuals that I'm not the prescribing physician. You need to follow the protocols and procedures according to as you understand them and to communicate appropriately with Dr. Kiefer. That has always been our process. And if anybody sees me, I hope that clarifies it.
Okay, and I just want to clarify that my question is actually based on your earlier testimony, and I tried to craft that as much around the verbiage that you used in my perception of that verbiage. So whether there was confusion or not, I'm not sure, but I did want to make that part clear. Dr. Stadler, that's all the questions I have right now. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
I want to say here that you can do that, every question you need. Dr. Brad, question for him.
No, I think everything is already answered. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Gallagher?
I have a quick question. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, that's
fine. You mentioned that one of the possibilities for this complaint against you was, or the proceedings were triggered, was that she was not good with her chart notes. And I'm just wondering, what was the trigger to, in your opinion, that would cause her to do something so drastic just to cover up her lack of chart notes? Was there something that came to light? Was there, I guess, making that statement, I'm confused why her lack of chart notes would possibly be a trigger for this whole thing to get rolling. And maybe I misunderstand what you said.
No, I don't know if you misunderstand, because again, we can, at this point, because nobody's ever communicated to me their concern at any point before I was indicted by before the indictment came through in December. So I don't know what people's motives or intentions are. We can say this. The report we have evidence through the practice fusion of Dr. Kiefer accessing my wife's historic prescription list, meaning she accessed what prescriptions she was on. It correlates with the day in which one of the medical assistants or staff asked for permission for refill while my wife was in the office. We know that she was looking at chart notes in the year prior, downloading my wife's full medical history and records. And so, again, this didn't come to light in January of 2020. And then suddenly there's this awareness that something's going on, and she reports it. Again, the evidence suggests that there's a sort of growing issue that's not being expressed or discussed in some regard. And again, because we have the evidence that she wasn't in the dark. She knew what my wife was prescribed and what was taken, and she had it and reviewed it under her own chart notes through the office. So, but what inspired her in January to do that? I don't know.
If I could just add, this is Mel McDonald again. A lot of what we put in there, when you look at something, you try to find a motive for something happening. Dr. Kiefer, with a lady that's been a patient for over a decade, from somebody that she worked with for years and years, to suddenly ambushed him while she's going to the office every day. If there's a problem in my law practice, if somebody is covering something or doing something with a client and I have a question, I'll reach out to them. They don't even need to be a friend. But when we suddenly saw what happened, you go, and I can't read her mind, but when you suddenly see a civil lawsuit filed on the heels of the reference to law enforcement authorities, all of the things that happened, getting money, the disputes, the argument over what the amount of money she's paying, you try to search for a reason. What would be their motive? And so I'm sure Dr. Kiefer would deny any motive. But the fact of the matter remains, the lawsuit's there. We've got the witness statements from people who worked there that corroborated that they would go to Dr. Kiefer before filling prescriptions. And we noticed that when we saw the PCS report that was inadequate, and so we went in there and had this done with reference to the pending case. It's been there almost 6 months. Dr. Porter has not even yet been fingerprinted. The U.S. attorney has agreed that we're developing this, we're showing this information. We didn't want him even to be fingerprinted, to have that within the law enforcement system. And we've agreed again and again to do that while we gather and collect this information. So when you see that her motive for charting, for example, this is a lawyer
sitting there trying to figure out why in the world would somebody do this to somebody that you called a friend, to his patient and to her doctor husband. And so these were motives that we saw, and whether the board accepts them or not, these were just very when she asked, I didn't know any of these things were happening. So we got person after person in the office who vouches that they talked to her and she said, go ahead and do it, and then they call it in. That to me is pretty compelling. Why would she do that and then turn around and do what she's done to Dr. Border?
Ms. Gallon, do you have any comments?
I don't know. Okay. Hey, Dr. Porter, quick question. How many years have Dr. Kiefer been working at the office?
12 years.
12 years?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, since about 2010, so we're talking 10 years. But I was a patient for 12 years. That was the confusion.
So we'll need, I mean, circle right real quickly back through the list here, because we're going to need to draw closer to the case. In this case, it's not in reference to Dr. Kiefer, it's in reference to Dr. Porter. So I need to draw closure to this. Case number 20-168. Dr. Kiefer, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think we're going to hear from Dr. Kiefer and her lawyer potentially, correct?
On the agenda?
Yeah, they are scheduled to speak, if you would like to hear from them.
Okay. Yeah, that would be fine. So let's bring them in at this point. Dr. Kiefer, are you and your legal representative there?
Yes.
Okay. And can you give us the name of your attorney?
Yes, I'll announce myself. This is Rina Rai, spelled R-I-N-A. My last name is R-A-I, and I'm representing Dr. Kiefer.
R-A-R-A-I, you said?
Yes, R-A-I.
Thank you. So let's hear your version of the story. We could.
Sure. This is Rina Rai. I'd like to just kind of make a few opening remarks, and then we have gone through the litany of documents that have been disclosed or provided and tried to kind of sift it down to something more manageable and easy to follow. And so after I kind of give my remarks, we are prepared for Dr. Kiefer to walk you through some of these documents and demonstrate to you how those sort of clarify some of the issues that are in front of the board today. And so if you'd like, she can do that after, 5 minutes with me. And, of course, any questions that you might have, she can answer as well. But to kind of go straight to one point made by Mr. McDonald, there's a couple things. In the law practice, if you come across another lawyer that has violated some ethical rule, you don't just go and talk to them and then make it go away. We have ethical responsibilities and a duty to report that to the appropriate agencies or risk discipline against our license ourselves. So it is not the case that when you come across what is unquestionably unethical and potentially criminal and potentially civilly culpable actions that you do something about it. So Dr. Kiefer doesn't deny any motive in this case. She did have motive, and that motive was to do the right thing. And this body would recognize, I think, readily, that the right thing to do when you come across someone utilizing your DEA number to prescribe controlled medications to his wife for a sustained period of time is to report it. And that's exactly what she's done here. To assign some nefarious other motive it should be, looked upon questionably by the board here. Dr. Kiefer was a friend and considered the Porters friends of hers. She worked successfully at the East Valley location for approximately 10 years. He had a thriving business and a client base there and a patient base there that she didn't want to lose. There is no assigned ulterior motive for her other than to do what was right. So, in fact, Dr. Kiefer will explore with you how it is that she came across, learning about what happened here and how it all came about. And then having to wrestle with that difficult decision between doing what the board expects you to do, protecting her own license and livelihood, and, you know, rather than brushing it under the rug and continuing. This idea that somehow this is all to protect herself or insulate herself from the board scrutiny relative to her ability to chart appropriately is as ridiculous as it sounds. If Dr. Kiefer were afraid of a review by this board of the way that she charts, the manner she charts, or the adequacy of her charts, she certainly wouldn't, the last thing she would have done is brought this claim forward, inviting that review, which of course Dr. Porter seems to want to, you know, shift the spotlight from himself to Dr. Kiefer and her lack of charting. And it's interesting because in this particular case, as you guys go through it, you'll see that, you know, what's not here is as important as what is, which are no emails from the staff saying, Dr. Kiefer, you know, JP wants a refill. Is that okay? Where are those emails? There are emails that flow from Dr. Porter directly to his staff that unequivocally instruct his staff what to do. You even have an email where Dr. Kiefer, and she'll point it out, but where Dr. Kiefer asked Dr. Porter, I'm hearing something about Julie. Does she need anything? And the response is she's good. Not, nope, we called in the prescription, you know, utilizing your name and number. So it really is this issue and the wrestling and the struggling that they have to come up with and assign some motive is because there really is no motive other than to do the right thing. So that's why we're here today, and we thank the board for the invitation to come in and talk with the board, and I thank the board member that has already commented that, you know, this isn't about Dr. Kiefer. Dr. Kiefer does not have any, that she's aware of, complaints made to the board. She's not under investigation, not criminally, not by the DEA or otherwise. And really, in that criminal matter, has been regarded and identified as the victim of potential crimes committed by Dr. Porter. She's also classically a whistleblower, you know, in this instance, and she has been treated with the utmost respect from the DEA and the law, you know, the federal prosecutors in this case, and, you know, obviously would look to and expect and request the same from this tribunal. It appears to me that Dr. Porter and his attorney, I think, who is also his criminal defense attorney, is utilizing two tactics to sort of deflect culpability or responsibility here. One is to bury the board's paperwork, and we did provide Gail this afternoon with the complete versions of the transcripts, the telephone calls between Dr. Kiefer and Dr. Porter. And without going into it, you know, and spending an enormous amount of time, I know you guys are pressed for time here, but on the interview or the telephone call October 28th, at page 15, starting at line 18, we've got Dr. Porter saying that he intended to bury this board with paperwork that would take 40 to 60 hours to go through. And so, you know, we've got that occurring. And then the second to that, we've got let's blame and shift responsibilities, Dr. Kiefer, and make some more, of a victim in this case. So we thank this board for, you know, resisting, you know, those particular tactics. But it does seem to be the case. As I said, Dr. Kiefer is going to go through and tell you how it is that she came across this inadvertently and why the documents that are presented to the board here really demonstrate and answer, I think, the questions that we're here to answer for the board or shed light on, which is, did Dr. Porter utilize Dr. Kiefer's DEA number to prescribe control medication over a sustained period of time to his wife without her permission, without her authorization, and against and in violation of the applicable rule. And then two, you know, did he provide the board with credible evidence related to this lack of record keeping that really supposedly explains it all? Dr. Porter would have this tribunal believe that for some unknown reason, Dr. Keeper woke up one day and decided, I'm going to make a claim against Dr. Porter. I'm going to upend my career. I'm going to lose patients. I am going to put myself in a financial stranglehold, all because, you know, I don't take good notes, or just, you know, none of that really kind of makes any sense. So as we go through, I just wanted to kind of to summarize what I think that you're going to be able to get from Dr. Keeper here. Exhibit number one and the documents that we prepared under exhibit number one really demonstrate that under practice fusion, it was Dr. Porter who was prescribing all of these, and when I say all, 98% of these medications to his wife. In practice fusion, on the particular date, he is listed as the prescribing doctor. So then show you the MyRx documentation that show on those same dates, when it went to calling it in, it was called in under her name. So when Dr. Porter explains to this board about the systems that they use internally, he tries to suggest this couldn't have occurred because Dr. Keeper would have had to put her name and password into Practice Fusion. But the documents that we provided here clearly demonstrate that he was the one under his name that went into Practice Fusion, and he is the one that initiated these prescriptions. It's just that by the time it was called in by his staff, it was called in utilizing Dr. Keeper's number. If that were not enough, we've got the internal records that looks like, or it sounds like some of you have reviewed at least, where it is clear and unambiguous that Dr. Porter is instructing his staff to call in these refills or prescriptions to begin with for his wife. And Dr. Keeper is nowhere in the loop. You would have thought at a minimum she could have been CC'd on this so that she could have said, no, I need to see her, or yes, I agree, or at least, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation where parties are arguing whether or not they were even notified as to calling in prescriptions, you know, instruction to do it by one doctor on behalf of another doctor. But if, you know, if that weren't enough, which I think it is, we've got and provided the relevant portion of the telephone calls and the transcripts of the same, which were transcribed by Fort Reporter. And this transcription clearly demonstrates, again, Dr. Keeper will go through it, but demonstrates where Dr. Porter himself, during these phone calls, admits that he would, in fact, ask his staff to call in prescriptions under another doctor's name. So I don't know how much more evidence there could be on the first question of whether or not this occurred. It did. But then we've got the second exhibit, and we've got subparts there that really kind of just go to responding to some of the claims by Dr. Porter that somehow this is the result of Dr. Keeper's you know, lack of chart notes, and the reason why there's not a chart note that you saw JP and she did in fact agree with these prescriptions is because she just doesn't write it down. What we've done is rather than spend an enormous amount of time and energy and resources in trying to go through every instance, we have come up with examples of several things. One is where it would appear that the chart notes have been modified or manipulated. We also have examples of where the information provided to this board by Dr. Porter on a particular patient were incomplete. And we know that because Dr. Keeper requested a record transfer for ongoing care of that patient at her other facility and obtained many more documents than what were turned over to this board to demonstrate the lack of record keeping. And one of those documents contained was indeed the chart note that they claim is missing. So, you know, I think we've got other examples of problems with the records that were provided, but in essence, we believe that those records could be incomplete, inaccurate, altered. There are instances where Dr. Kiefer has no chart note, according to Dr. Porter, but that's because she saw this particular patient at another facility she worked at, and she has provided a chart note for that patient on that day obtained from the other facility. So we can clearly demonstrate here where there's example after example after example of where Dr. Porter tries to suggest that the lack of record keeping is somehow a defense to the charges against him, but even still, those are just fraught with problems and misrepresentation. We've also lastly included correspondence between Dr. Kiefer and the DEA related to the investigation that clearly demonstrates Dr. Kiefer was viewed as an asset to the DEA, was viewed as a victim, and it was treated like a whistleblower. The DEA could have and did investigate the case thoroughly and found no wrongdoing on the part of Dr. Kiefer. And so we've included those records as well. And that really goes to what was happening in 2020. Julie Kiefer was, in fact, looking at JP records because she was asked to do so and cooperating with the DEA. And so that's the reason that occurred. But Dr. Kiefer will also explain that that same system, during the dependency of the investigation by this board, she was locked out of it by Dr. Porter. It's discussed in the telephone calls. And during that period of time, his office, himself or his employee, who was the sister of JP, accessed JP's records over 500 times in a period of 3 days, while simultaneously locking Dr. Kiefer out of the same. For what purpose and to what end, I guess we'll never know. We've also, again, just to remind you, provided Gail this afternoon or this morning with a complete record of both telephone call transcripts, just out of completeness, and so this board didn't think we were cherry-picking excerpts. I do encourage the board to review the entirety of those transcripts. They're not terribly long, but they certainly do add a lot of color to this particular matter, and it becomes clear that many of these conversations, for example, Dr. Kiefer asked, why are all these prescriptions under my name? I didn't write these. You don't hear Dr. Porter saying in these phone calls, yeah, you did. Don't you remember? We had conversations about it all the time. But that's the position that he takes here today, and it's just not consistent with those telephone calls, and those were recorded, and that was done at the request of the DEA and in cooperation with them as well. So with that, I wanted to give the board a snapshot of what we intend to show you here. I don't know how you want to proceed. We can answer questions, certainly. I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Kiefer. But we can also certainly kind of go through these so that she can demonstrate to you how these documents, prove that Dr. Porter initiated prescriptions for his wife, and by the time those got called in, the name of the doctor changed. I'll defer to the board on how they would like to proceed, but we are prepared to go through that process.
Thank you for your overview. So, Keith, as you know, this case is not your case, in reference to Dr. Porter. Can you kind of give just a condensed version, because we're running short of time,
yep,
what you think this got all this going, maybe in a couple paragraphs, from him asking you to write the prescriptions and then putting the prescriptions back on you? Any idea what the intent directly down 7th Street to you.
I'm not sure that I understand the question. What was his internal spark to do what?
To basically have the issue with you, or what was the issue with you with him, meaning that what got this all going?
Okay. Sure. I'm happy to speak with you because I'm never happy to go in front of a board, but I'm happy for this to be one step closer to closure. Because this did start for me in January 2020. On January 6, 2020, I was back in the office after being gone on holiday. And I was reviewing all of the paperwork that was in my inner office mailbox, which are faxes and refill requests and labs and things like that. And as I'm going through this stack, I see a prescription refill request that I knew I hadn't written. Because around the time that the benzodiazepine, the opioid crisis, I kind of lumped benzos in with that. I literally am really aware of every single control that I write that even comes close to those. So when I see a six-month prescription that's asking for a refill that I knew I didn't write, I called the pharmacist. And I asked how that was originally received. And I was told it was received from MC, who is the office manager, but is also Dr. Porter's sister-in-law, which gave me a red flag. So I went into the TMC and ran a report on JP. And what I found, and I've included this for you in Exhibit 1, it's the PMC report, which is basically about 7 to 8 pages. It's 101 prescriptions, 98 of which are under my name, from April 2012 until January 6th of 2020. When you see that, that's what completely put me into a state of shock. And so I left the office stunned that day, went home and did some research and found I had 24 hours to report this or I was indicated and could be seen as guilty. And so that's exactly what I did. I called the DEA office first and I called the medical board second. It wasn't about trying to do something to Dr. Porter. This was about protecting my license. And I had no idea what this was. Road this was going down, it was a legal responsibility, an ethical responsibility, and it wasn't meant as anything negative. In fact, it's extremely sad because I knew the entire family. She just needs a minute. And what it's done to my world, it's really not good. In my practice. So I'm here. I'm a big girl. And I'm going to answer any questions that you might have. I can walk you through the documents we've given you. These documents are a sampling of the entirety of what we have. But it's not a question. I didn't know about these prescriptions. And there were close to 10,000 pills written. I think I would know it, and I think I would be aware if 10,000 pills of a controlled substance were prescribed to a single individual under my name. The office is largely staffed by his own family members. So to say that you're having reports that I was consulted prior to sending in the script is not true. And I am prepared to go through the exhibits with you to explain to you what you have in front of you, if you would like me to.
I've been through them, and I mean, they're just the things that I understand. I need to discuss with board members what their feelings are and take them through the phone. I need to stick to task, and let me start keeping my mind on the field. we need to roll through this and try to conclude this. Now that you've seen and you've asked and heard from Dr. Cooper's attorney, can you tell me what your thoughts are?
Well, I mean, just one quick question, Dr. Cooper. I think obviously the data and information you guys have described it or provided has been fairly compelling. I will say one question, though. Do you get the quarterly report on your PMT prescribing habits?
I do get the quarterly report, and because I'm never out of range, I'm always like lower than other doctors because I just don't write them. And so understanding that I have two patients that have chronic pain issues, and I know exactly what they're on, so seeing that I'm low, it never put a flag. It never gave me a flag.
But I mean, like you said, you became acutely aware of the benzo issues and opioid issues. And so, I mean, when we're talking about TID dosing daily, it seems like that would be potentially higher than what you're personally doing with your own patients. Maybe not, but, you know, it certainly spikes your numbers higher than would be expected for the two patients or couple patients you've got during the benzo. So just that's the only thing that gives me a slight bit of pause is that should have definitely come up on your PMP report and been like, well, that seems a little off, you know. But I hear what you're saying on the other sentence, and I think it certainly is compelling evidence. I think that's just surprising you might not have seen seen that show up in there essentially. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was usually a simple bar graph that just showed other prescribers and what you prescribe, and so no concerns. That was well under that. And it wasn't you had to dig deeper to see like the actual numbers associated with it. So it never raised a flag for me.
I gotcha. No, I just was thinking that with your description of being very acutely aware and taking prescriptions that are not doing benzos, it just seems like with the numbers written for this patient, it might have shown up. So, you know, I guess I hear you, Dr. Sadler, that we're looking to wrap things up. I think we need to kind of get a little bit more of walk through some of this stuff because I guess if the preponderance of evidence suggests exactly what it's looking like, then this is kind of a big difference between a, you know, small issue and losing your license issue. So I feel like we need a little bit more. I think we need to be walked through some of these exhibits potentially a little bit more in depth. I guess just more so, what are you thinking, Dr. Cooper? Point, I guess. That's what I'm interested in. So before you answer that, I guess I'd like to see what the rest of the board has to say.
Thank you, Dr. Field. Ms. Bibbitt, your viewpoint on this?
My question was similar to what Dr. Popio just asked, just hearing 10,000 pills, a huge number. Over what period of time was that?
From 2012 to 2020. From April of 2012 to January of 2020.
So you're talking 8 years span.
8 years.
Okay.
7 years.
And I'm sorry, Ms. Tippett, you were saying that you.
Oh, my question was similar to Dr. Popio, just trying to understand the quantity and maybe not being aware of that, not that it was curiosity on that. But 8 years, how many different medications? Is that something that, I mean, I've seen a lot of different medications named in the paperwork, but I'm just curious if that, if it was primarily the same medications or there's a lot of different medications being prescribed?
That's a great question. And if you look at page 4 of exhibit 1 is the PMP report for JP. And that's exactly the report that I saw when I pulled it up on January 6th of 2020. They are predominantly alprazolam, clonazepam, and soma. If you look before I was on the scene and my VA was being used, those exact meds were being prescribed by Dr. Porter.
Okay, thank you.
This is Mel McDonald. I would just note for the record, what you've apparently been provided, we have not been provided. I don't know what exhibit one is. We would like the opportunity of reviewing that package before any decision is made, and to address some of the issues. For example, if there are multiple witnesses who we could provide to the board that would testify that they specifically talked to Dr. Kiefer, got her approval before prescriptions were written. When they talk about the motive, the fact that she's filed a lawsuit seeking enormous damages for her claim, when we talk about the motives, I don't have a clue, nor does my client have a clue what's in the package. They talk about the confrontation call that was made. This is a call that is typically set up by DEA, where Dr. Kiefer calls and it holds her out and herself out that Dr. Porter is a victim, that the feds are looking at her. And so from a scripted call, they make a transcript of it that was set up by law enforcement. And Dr. Porter is sitting there sympathetic to her because she's now got concerns. So we would like to see what their exhibits are and then be able to respond to that. What we were provided by the board doesn't include apparently what they gave you this morning.
Dr. Campbell, and we can go into depth if we need, but Dr. Campbell, do you have any viewpoints so far from what you've heard, seen? Remember,
yeah,
this is
I do. Yeah, I think with an executive, though.
Okay. So it is 3:20, and executive for what reason?
Legal advice.
Okay. I'll second your motion.
I'm sorry, this is the slide. Could I ask Dr. Kiefer something really quick?
Sure.
Yeah. Dr. Kiefer, so when you find out that your DEA have been used for a prescription, did you approach the front desk, the manager, did you talk to them at all? I'm just curious, what's the process that you went through?
So when I saw the list, when I pulled up the PMP report, I was so stunned and I was shocked and angry. And so I was on my way to Dr. Porter's room to confront him on it. And someone stopped me and said, you better get legal counsel before you go doing that. So I left the office, I called my business coach, and I just kind of went through it, like, what do I do right now? And so he helped me do the research that I had 24 hours, and so the route would be clear of what I had to do. Once I did that, I met with the DEA and legal counsel. It was, I would say, suggested or requested that I stay in that office, which was not easy at all, to continue going into work as though nothing's going on while an investigation is happening. And in fact, they were going to wire me up. It was going to be a special operation, and that was changed at the last minute.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions. Thank you.
Dr. Sadlick, this is Karen Tibbetts. I have a quick question for Dr. Kiefer. Dr. Kiefer, do you remember at any time, I'm not suggesting each and every time that Dr. Porter and his attorneys have said that you were consulted, but do you remember at any time being asked about renewing prescriptions or on behalf of his wife?
When I joined the practice early on, I was part of her care minimally. I saw her for aesthetics, and in the last several years, I never 2018, I saw her once or twice. I was never her general physician. So did staff come to me and ask me, and I said, yeah, go ahead and call it in? I do not have that recollection at all.
Okay, thank you.
Real quick question, Dr. Kiefer, before we go into executive. Is your practice primarily cosmetic?
It is, well, there's a lot to it. It is aesthetic. I do some hormones. I do minor surgical procedures. Sexual enhancement. I don't do a large amount of general. I'm not a primary care for most people.
I'm going to retract a little bit. Dr. Campbell made the motion to go into executive session for legal advice. I second it. And can I get a quick roll call?
Dr. Sadlick?
Aye.
Dr. Popia?
Aye.
Ms. Tibbetts?
Aye.
Ms. Gallen?
Aye.
Dr. Campbell? That's right. Dr. Rubin's recused. Is that everybody? I think that's everybody.
Okay. 326, sponsor executive session.